Welcome to the theater. Take a seat, grab some popcorn, and get ready for another horror movie double bill. This is Friday Night Fratricide.
Good evening, and welcome back to Friday Night Fratricide. You gotta roll your R's. Roll your R's.
Where? I already rolled it all the way down here.
Yeah, I know. You've done well.
You have to roll it all the way home.
I'll give you a lift. It's fine. Don't worry about it. My name is Fraser.
My name is Ewan.
Question mark?
You don't normally say my name is. You normally say I'm.
Well, that is my
name. I'm thrown off.
It's accurate.
Oh, you I'm all on edge.
You got to respond. That's the whole point of banter. You got to give and get, you know?
Yeah.
Yes, yes, yes. It's time for another horror movie double bill. This week we have, was it Waxworks, Mannequins and Dummies? Was that the full title?
Could be. I wrote Dummies, Waxworks and Mannequins.
It's the same thing.
Yeah, but it's in a different order.
But it's the same. It's the same three things.
Yeah, but it's in a different order. The order's important.
No, it's not.
Sure it is. If you had a sandwich, you wouldn't have the fillings on the outside and the two bits of bread in the middle, would you?
And in this example...
Title sandwich.
The mannequins are...
The dummies and the mannequins the ham, are yeah. The bread, and the waxworks is the ham.
Yeah, all right.
Waxworks is a pretty hammy movie, so... I think that fits the metaphor.
It's late. It's a spooky night tonight. Not yeah. To give too much away when we're recording this. I'm just not going to engage with your patter.
Okay.
It's going to make for a fun podcast.
I thought banter was about giving and getting.
Right. Don't use my own words against me. Okay. That's just not cricket. Yes, yes, yes. Tonight we have Dead of Night, a classic in every sense of the word.
Yeah.
And Waxwork.
Yeah.
Not a classic.
Not a classic.
In
any sense of the word.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, very different films. Despite the fact that they both do vaguely fit the theme, yours more, you picked Waxwork. Definitely fits the theme more, whereas Dead of Night is an anthology and only one of the segments features a dummy.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, very different films.
Yeah.
Very different films.
Which do you want to start with?
Should we do chronologically?
Sure.
Start with
Dead of Night first.
Dead of Night first. It is... Old school, very old school.
It is.
Yes, Dead of Night, 1945. Mm. Not quite the earliest film we've covered. We did Bride of Frankenstein.
Bride of Frankenstein was a little earlier.
But still on the earlier side, we've not done that many classics, you know, pre... We've done a few sort of 50s, 60s Hammer horror, but we've not done many before that. I think just Dead of Night and... Bride of Frankenstein
are the
only sort of originals, not originals, like
the only like kind of pre-50s.
Yeah. So it had multiple directors. It's got a lot of varying stories in the anthology, all tied together with the plot of a man named Walter Craig, who is an architect or surveyor or something. And he's been called out to this countryside cottage where he's going to do an evaluation on this house. The owner's called him out, Foley. I can't remember all their names. I'm going to struggle with their names.
Yeah.
I'll do my best. Foley, who's invited him out. And he's got some friends around. They're having a little get-together and a cup of tea and high tea when you get sandwiches
I
and
guess,
a little
yeah.
tray. And
yeah.
And Walter Craig has come out and he's acting very strangely. They all kind of introduce themselves and he's kind of a bit apprehensive and we don't really know what's going on at this point. We don't know where the plot is going, but he tells the group and says, "I've dreamt this. I've dreamt this scene before. I know. I've seen all you before. Mm-hmm. I know what's going to happen. I know that a woman is going to come in and talk to with dark hair is going to come in and talk to us later. I know that you're going to break your glasses." Mm-hmm. And it's all, it's like, oh, okay. And that kind of leads them into the topic of sort of deja vu and weird things that have happened to them. And so they each tell a story. I just pinged the microphone stand.
Yeah.
And they each tell this story of something strange that happened to them.
Yeah.
To varying results. Some are definitely better than others.
The stories are very mixed. Some of them are good, some of them aren't.
Yeah.
But it's a good setup, I think. It's
yeah, it works well.
Very much. I mentioned this last week when we were talking about it, this like the just the anthology films in general. This was the first English language anthology film, which is really cool. At the time, it wasn't even called an anthology. It was called a portmanteau film.
Oh, portmanteau.
That was the old name that they used. And then in the 60s and into the 70s, Amicus did a bunch of them, which I've talked about a lot because I really like Amicus. And Milton Subotsky, the producer and one of the founders of Amicus, this film was his favorite film. Yeah. So you see a lot of the influence from this in the later films.
Oh, yeah.
And that setup of like a bunch of people together talking about their own weird experiences is like in pretty much all of the Amicus films.
Yeah.
Like we saw it in Asylum, is that it's all these people that are in the asylum together talking about the stories of what drove them insane and got them put in there. In like Vault of Horror, it's a bunch of people get stuck in a lift, or like they're in a lift and then they wind up getting stuck on a floor where there's no way off, and they're talking about their recurring dreams that they keep having. So it's like similar.
Yeah, similar idea.
Vein. It's like a real kind of classic setup for an anthology film.
Yeah.
And this is the first time that did that. And I think it's a really cool setup.
I think it works really well. Yeah, because you're kind of wondering what, throughout the whole thing, even though you're listening to these different stories, you're still curious about who this guy is. Why does he know them?
Yeah.
Why has he dreamt them before? And for 1945, it's pretty creepy.
Yeah.
There's some moments that are creepier than others that I'll get to, but mm-hmm. like the idea of it is quite unsettling. And yeah. I think it must have been for the time as well. You know, horror wasn't super common at that point.
No. Yeah, that idea of like, I know that something bad is going to happen and I don't know what.
Yeah.
Is
impending creepy. Dread.
And like, I think they build it up quite well in that it's like, at first they're trying to disprove anything about it, and then they kind of realize that actually some of the things that he's predicted are starting to happen.
Yeah.
When it's like, and then they start trying to skirt around it because he talks about the one of the people that's there is a young woman. It's like, oh, because she leaves early, and it's after she leaves that the bad things start happening. So then they go to invite her for dinner, because then it's like, oh, but then if she doesn't leave, then the bad things aren't going to happen.
Yeah.
And then her mum comes in and is like, oh, you forgot, it's your uncle's birthday, we need to go and see him, and like drags her out. And then it's like that inevitability of it starts to set in, that it's like something bad is going to happen, whether you like it or not. And at this point, we know that something bad is going to happen. They've basically proved it, but we still don't know what it is.
Yeah.
And it works, and then they keep cutting away to all of these stories, and it's like, it's almost that frustration that like we're not being let in on the scary thing yet, and that just builds the tension even more.
The I can't remember what I was going to say. I literally started that sentence and I just it blanked.
Sorry, I hope that's not me distracting.
No, that there's that spooky thing that's happened to me.
Yeah,
that I've just completely. That's just because my memory's garbage. Yeah. Yeah. So. Few different stories. We start with Hugh Granger, who is a race car driver, the classic looking race cars, which was very cute.
I thought they were very funny. Yeah. I like it, gets a laugh out of me when you see the like 1920s ass race cars.
Yeah. They look so unserious.
They're like the Monopoly piece race cars. Yeah, they're really funny.
He's in a car crash, which is not funny. Don't laugh at that.
No.
And wakes up, I don't know, a couple of days later, nights later, I don't know. And he goes outside or opens the window to see a man outside in a hearse.
Mm-hmm.
Like a horse-drawn hearse. Is there a name for that?
It was a horse. Carriage? Before they were motorized, that's just what horses were.
Yeah. And this, yeah, very creepy-looking old man in his black garb and his hat and everything. Yeah, there's this the hearse driver outside with the black garb, and he's got his little top hat on, and he looks up to the window where Hugh's standing. He says, "What is it? What's the exact line? Because I always get it wrong. I always say there's room for one more.
I think it's just room for one more inside, sir. Just what he says.
There's room for one inside, sir.
Yeah,
such a good line.
It is.
It's just such a. There's something about it that's just so creepy and unsettling."
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, you're going to take me away in the hearse. I'm going to die. And it's like, I don't know. It works for me.
It's creepy.
It is just. It's just kind of. I don't want to say iconic because I don't know how many people have actually heard it, but it should be.
Yeah, I know that this is based off of a short story. I think pretty much all of the segments are based off of short stories. I don't really know what the original short story is, like how long it is or anything, but I read a modernized version of this short story in school. I don't know how old I would have been. Really? I want to say like late primary school, so I was maybe like 11 or 12, and I remember really enjoying it. It's like, you know, for like close reading where you sit and analyze a little like 2-page long short story or whatever, and I remember reading it. Was like it was a modernized version because it was like, it wasn't a bus crash. It was specifically a lift collapsing.
Right.
But it was the same premise. And I want to say it was a woman as the main character rather than a man. They didn't really go into context of like the car crash. It was just sort of a woman got up in the middle of the night, has the vision of the hearse. Then the next day is like out at the shops and goes to get into a lift and sees the person standing at the lift and says the same thing. And then the lift crashes. And I remember finding that really, really interesting. I really liked that story. And then when I watched this for the first time, I was like, oh my God, it's that short story that I read in primary school, which is fun. Obviously, that's not where it was from originally, but like this short story that it's based on, it's a lot of fun.
So as you said,
I just spoiled
the ending. almost 100 years after it came out.
Yeah.
He gets out of hospital, and then sort of the next day he's walking down to the bus stop, and as he's standing to get on the bus, the conductor leans out to him and says, "Just room for one inside, sir." And he has this like moment of panic and can't get on the bus.
Mm-hmm.
And then the bus gets T-boned by like a lorry. It's a beautiful scene, by the way. These little miniature cars, the way they used to do it.
Yeah.
And this little, the crash, and then the bus flies off the overpass and explodes, and it's all very dramatic. But it looks so cute with the little cars. And it's a really short segment as well. It's only like a few minutes. It's really not long. But I love it. I think it works really well. I think just that, the concise nature of the story, it doesn't need to say much, and it still manages to kind of creep you out a bit.
Yeah.
It's impressive.
I like it. It's a very simple idea, and they pull it off really well. I think it's a bit, like, this isn't me criticizing it. I think it's a bit tame by today's standards. I think a lot of people, if they were to watch that, or if you were to try and do that kind of story now, people would be like, oh, that's it. Like, that's nothing.
Yeah.
They wouldn't find it scary or whatever. But I think if you really sort of put yourself into the mindset of, like, being that close to dying and having that, like, it's just the effectiveness of it, the visuals of the hearse and the, you know,
the man turning around and saying the line.
The hearse driver. I don't know if you recognize the hearse driver. He's in a film that we covered not that long ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Miles Mallison, who, not a super well-known actor. One of the roles that he's best known for is, like, not a big role at all. He was in Brides of Dracula, the second Hammer Dracula film, which we haven't covered. But he was also in Peeping Tom.
Oh, was he?
He's the guy fairly near the beginning when he goes into the shop and he is like buying the pornography in the shop.
Is that him?
That's him. That was Miles Mallison. And this would have been, what, but 15 years afterwards? 1960 was Peeping Tom? 59, 60?
Yeah.
And this was, yeah. But yeah, there you go. That was him.
Brilliant. I didn't recognize really any of the actors. The only one I did was, now let me just check. Was it Sally Ann Howes?
Is she the young one?
Who played the teenager?
Yeah.
Is she the one who's in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang?
Yes, she was the... Yeah, she's the woman from Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
Yeah.
What's her name? Truly Scrumptious.
Yeah.
What's her name?
I had no idea that was what they were called. I've not seen Chitty Chitty Bang Bang since I was a child.
I don't know if I've ever seen it.
Have you not?
Like, all the way through.
It's terrifying.
Yeah.
The child catcher
is very scary. I didn't recognize many of the actors. I specifically went and looked up the actor that plays Hugh in the first segment, because I thought I recognized him, but then I couldn't think, like, looking through his filmography, I couldn't find anything else I had seen, so I don't know where I recognized him from. But I did find out that he's from Hillhead in Glasgow.
Oh, really?
Which I thought was kind of funny. Like, you don't think of actors as being from Hillhead.
I guess, yeah.
I suppose it's a fairly nice part of Glasgow.
Yeah. Good
but
for him.
It's still,
he made it out of Hillhead.
It's funny, the idea of, like, being from Glasgow and becoming an actor. It's not unheard of. It's just funny.
Yeah, that's true. Brian Cox is from Dundee.
He is. He is from
Dundee.
He's
from Broughty Ferry.
Yeah.
How about that?
There you go.
Next segment.
Yeah.
Moving on.
Yeah.
So Sally is the next one to tell the story. She's the youngest. She's like it's supposed to be like a teenager in the group. I don't know how old she actually is. And is telling the story of a Christmas party.
Mm-hmm.
And they all the kids decide to go and play hide and seek. So she goes out and she finds a door that leads to a little bedroom,
mm-hmm,
with two little kids in it that she doesn't recognize.
Are there two kids? There's only one, isn't there?
Is it just the one?
That's just the wee boy, isn't it?
Is it just the boy?
I don't remember there being a second kid.
Did I just picture
The Shining?
Maybe I looked away and saw the second kid.
I only remember there being one. Maybe I wasn't paying enough attention.
I don't know. One of us wasn't. Probably me, to be fair. Finds a little boy who's, like, needing to go to sleep. He's upset and needs to go.
Yeah.
And she tucks him in and says goodnight and then goes back to the party,
mm-hmm,
at which point she's told that the little boy, what's his name?
I can't remember.
Whatever his name is. She mentions it to one of the other party guests, and they say, like, oh yes, there was a little boy by that name. He was murdered by his sister when he was a child. And you're like, oh, so he was a ghosty.
Yeah, he's a little ghost boy.
And then the segment ends, and you're like, that's it.
It's not incredibly exciting. I think the idea of, like, the, you know, you meet a character in an old house and then it turns out that they were actually a ghost is at this point a bit of an overdone trope.
Yeah.
I think this is one of those films where you kind of need to go, like, but at the time that was more interesting. Like, now it feels very boring. And admittedly, I don't think it's a particularly enjoyable segment anyway, because not an awful lot happens, and
it just feels very boring. It really just, like, the first one is so, I think it's because it's short, it's so enjoyable.
Yeah.
Because it just works really well. Whereas this one is a little bit longer, but less happens.
Yeah.
It doesn't really work.
It has an all right conclusion. I think the reason that it's not as impactful is just because we've seen so many other stories doing the same thing.
Quite probably. Yeah, quite probably. Yeah, not as big a fan of the second one. The third story, Joan is the sort of second woman in the group, the older lady, and she tells a story of when she brought home a mirror for her husband, Peter, I think his name is.
Mm.
And when he looks into the mirror, he sees a completely different room behind him.
Yeah.
He sees an old sort of, it's not quite gothic, but it's like,
oh yeah, sort of like
Victorian, Edwardian's point. Yeah, not quite. Yeah, it's this old room with a fireplace, and no one else is in the mirror. It's just him seeing it. And he gradually goes more and more insane. This is quite a long, this is a bit of a longer segment. Mm-hmm. It kind of takes quite a while to build up. I know I'm glossing over it quite quickly, but it does build it up quite well. He kind of gradually gets more and more aggressive towards Joan and doesn't really know what's happening. And as she starts to look into it, she finds out that the owner of the mirror, the previous owner of the mirror, killed his wife.
Yeah.
And then killed himself.
Mm-hmm.
And after she finds that out, she tries to confront him and get rid of the mirror. And he has, like, started to turn into the murderer.
Yeah.
There's some really nice, like, shots where, like, he's strangling her. Mm-hmm. And then, that's not why it's nice. Yeah. he's strangling her and then looks into the mirror. And then in the mirror, it's the other, it's the killer, it's someone else.
Yeah.
And
she sees the, like, the other reflection for the first time at this point, which is cool. Yeah, they have the whole thing that, like, he murders his wife out of jealousy. He becomes convinced that she was cheating on him. And then that's what starts to happen here. He becomes really jealous of his wife having a friend called Guy, who, like, the two of them at the start of the segment, they kind of joke about, like, oh, it's just this guy who kind of likes me. And I sort of string him along and it's a bit funny and they both kind of have a laugh about it. Uh-huh. But then by the end of the segment, he gets really jealous about it and tries to kill her.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting.
It works well as a segment. It's not the scariest.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. I don't think it's the scariest part of the film. I think it's probably the best. I would say it's the best segment. Mm. I feel like as much as I like the first segment, I feel like it's just a really solid idea. It's done very well, but it doesn't have enough time to build up a real investment in the story or, like, for anything especially interesting to happen. Whereas this third one, it's just the right length that you, like, get nice and involved and you really start to enjoy it.
Yeah.
And it builds up to a really solid climax as well. I think the characters are more well-defined. I don't know. I think it's just overall a better put-together short story.
Yeah. It's a good length for the story it tells. It gives you a chance to actually watch Peter's kind of decline into this madness. And yeah, as you say, it has a nice conclusion. It's not the scariest, but it works within the context. The next story is the worst.
The golf one.
By a fair bit.
Yeah.
I don't think it works at all. They tried to do a more comedic angle with it. It is deliberate. It is, like, deliberately supposed to be a bit funny. But I think it feels so out of place with the rest of the film. It really doesn't work. It's two golfers, best friends, and they're both in love with a woman.
Mm-hmm.
One of the guys cheats. They decide they're going to play a game of golf and whoever wins will get her hand in marriage.
Yeah.
And she's fine with that.
She's like, yeah, great idea, guys.
Very strange. The 40s were a different time.
Yeah. My note at that point was, this is the kind of thing that makes women feel really special.
Yeah. It's and how. Yeah. So one of the guys wins by cheating and the other guy walks into the lake.
He just straight up kills himself.
He just walks right into the lake.
Wild.
There's a scene, I always think about this, the scene in The Simpsons when Moe's old tutor kills himself. He has cancer and he doesn't want to live anymore. And he just walks into the lake and Moe shouts after him, is like, hey, you going for a swim? You ain't going to take your shoes off before you go for a swim? Oh. As he realizes, and that's all I could think, because he very slowly just walks into the lake. And then his hat floats on the top as he goes under. It's very silly.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, his ghost comes back to haunt the other guy.
And ruin his golf game.
And yeah, distract him and ruin his golf and ruin his marriage. And it's very silly. It doesn't work for me.
Yeah.
But the end, it also... Yeah, I don't know. It's just very silly. It's just, yeah. It's deliberately silly. And the horror aspect is that there is a ghost.
But it's not even like a... Like, the ghost isn't scary.
Yeah.
It's just the guy.
Yeah, it's just the guy.
The guy is back again. Dead. And he even talks about, like, oh, yeah, I went to heaven and I, like, learned how to become a ghost when I was in heaven. And now I'm just here to just wind you up. Like, there's no menace in the character at all. He's just a guy that's there. So there's, like, absolutely nothing scary about it.
The whole joke as well is that he can't get rid of it. He can't disappear. He can, like, disappear and reappear. And he's kind of like doing all these actions to make himself disappear. And then the alive guy at the end accidentally makes himself disappear.
Yeah.
At the end. And then it's implied that she's gonna...
It's implied that the ghost fucks his wife.
Yeah.
which is funny.
Is it meant to be funny?
I don't know.
It's very strange.
This story was written by H.G. Wells.
Oh. Good for him. I was wondering which one was him. But
yeah, it was this one, which surprised me.
Yeah.
Quite a lot, I got to be honest, because it's not good.
No, it's just not.
It's really not good.
It's not scary. It's not that funny.
There's not much to it.
It feels very out of place.
It's clearly trying to be funny. And I think the only reason that works in the bare minimum sense is that when they then cut back from that to this little, like, the little wraparound bit, the little interstitials, is it's the guy that owns the house, whose name I can't remember.
Foley.
That he's the one that's telling this story. And he, like, when it cuts back to him, everyone else in the room is laughing. And he kind of says, like, oh, I just wanted to lighten the mood a bit because everyone's been telling so many depressing stories.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of funny that, like, he would set up a story about, like, oh, this is my friend who died. And then there was, like, a spooky supernatural whatever. And then he was kind of just winding everyone up. And it turned out to just be this really totally silly story that no one was going to believe.
Yeah.
I think that's a kind of funny underlying thing.
Yeah.
It's just a shame that the story itself is really bad.
Yeah. And it sets you up for the last segment as well, which is... I mean, in my opinion, the scariest, but that's because I watched this when I was like 3 years old.
It's certainly the one that feels the most modern.
Yes.
To me.
Yes.
I don't know if I can really elaborate on that, but it definitely feels like this segment feels a bit out of place in a good way because it feels like this could
ahead
be a film from like the 70s.
Yeah.
The rest of the films have this, the rest of the segments, sorry, have this like kind of almost gothic feeling to them.
Yeah.
Even though they're modern, they have like, because, you know, the one with the mirror, it's like a gothic mirror and the room in the other side of the mirror is all gothic and like the hearse being drawn by the horses and the second story is in like an old gothic manner.
Yeah.
It has this kind very old fashioned feeling about it. And then this one's like, it's about show business. It's about, that I mean, we'll get to this, what that it's actually about, but it feels so much more modern, and I think the scary aspect of it isn't as old-fashioned, so it's more effective today.
Timeless scare.
Probably scared the shit out of people when they first watched it. Not that it scared the shit out of you when you first watched it.
I was too young to be watching this, by the way.
Yeah.
Like, there was no reason for that. I think I did beg my dad to... our dad to let me watch it, but so the last story, the last segment anyway, Dr. Van Straten is this old, I think, German.
Yeah,
he seems German,
I guess.
Don't know if he actually is German, but feels German.
Interesting choice for a British film in 1945.
Yeah, I mean, good for them, I guess.
Yeah.
He's not played as a villain.
That's
which
true.
Is a start. He's pretty charming and likable. He talks about his experience interviewing a man named Maxwell, who is a ventriloquist. And you know what ventriloquists did back in the day? They had those creepy ass dummies. Hugo is the name of Maxwell's dummy. And we see kind of his story and what led him up to be interviewed by the doctor. He's kind of under arrest as well. We don't really know. He's detained, basically. Yeah. He's being detained. So we know something bad has happened. And the short story kind of follows the plot of this American ventriloquist who turns up at the show, and Hugo kind of is sick of Maxwell. And even from the start, it's obviously played as like the act. You don't really know if it's part of the act or not. Mm-hmm. But Hugo is sick of Maxwell and doesn't actually like him and hates him and doesn't want to be friends with him anymore and wants to go off by himself or with someone else. And Maxwell's kind of seems very on edge about something. We don't really know. And as it goes on, Maxwell it kind of loses it a little bit.
Yeah.
We don't really know what's happening. He gets into a fight at a bar mm-hmm. after Hugo starts insulting these women that walk in. And we're kind of like, is he insulting them through Hugo or what's going on here? And we just kind of, yeah, it's very vague. We don't really know if he has a mind of his own or not. Mm-hmm. It's implied, but then we don't know. And it's like,
yeah.
So they have, they're staying in the same hotel room, Maxwell and the American ventriloquist, can't remember mm-hmm. his name, but Hugo goes missing that night mm-hmm. and Maxwell kind of completely loses it. He goes in and starts accusing the American guy of stealing Hugo, and you're going to take him and do your own act and copy me, and oh, what's going on? And then he finds Hugo in his room, yeah. even though it's very clear the American has no idea what's going on and, yeah. and what's happening. And then he shoots and kills the American.
Yeah.
because of, I guess, jealousy or possession by Hugo, or mm-hmm. we don't really know what's happened. But when he gets brought back to the, when he gets arrested and taken to the prison cell, we see that, Hugo kind of starts talking to him.
Yeah.
And taunting him, and, Maxwell smashes his head in.
Yeah, smashes Hugo.
Kills Hugo, destroys him, defeats him. And then he kind of, I don't know what happens. Either he has had a complete mental break. He gets like electroshock therapy.
Yeah.
You see the doctors kind of talking about giving him some kind of treatment, mm-hmm. and it's implied to be like electroshock. And then after that, he starts to speak with Hugo's voice.
Kind of becomes Hugo. Yeah. Oh, no, because the American guy doesn't die.
He's
wounded.
Yeah, sorry.
Because then he comes in at the end.
Yeah.
They're like, we want to see if you can talk to him. Snapped. And he goes in and tries to talk to him. And then it's like Hugo's voice.
Yeah.
He looks up and kind of smiles. And it's like the only person that he'll talk to is this other ventriloquist. And he's like talking in Hugo's voice. It's creepy.
It is creepy. It's very creepy.
Yeah.
I don't know. I like the story. I think living dummies are always going to be creepy, mm-hmm. regardless of who you are. For me, with an actual fear of them, more so. But like, I think for anyone, just living dolls is just a generally creepy trope. And this is the one that kind of kicked that all off. We have like magic and dead silence and
Goosebumps.
Yeah,
there was that episode of Goosebumps with the ventriloquist.
There is. Yeah,
there was an episode of Tales of the Crypt with a ventriloquist, Don Rickles and Bobcat Goldthwait.
Yeah,
play ventriloquists.
What's the other one? The Trilogy of Terror as well.
Yeah, well, that's not a ventriloquist.
It's not a ventriloquist. It's just a little doll. Like the little doll. Little just like living doll. Living puppets, like living dolls.
Chucky.
Yeah, as well. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And this kind of pioneered that. Yeah. I guess. But it's good. It's definitely my... I don't know, actually. I think the first segment's probably my favourite. Mm-hmm. But my favourite scene comes after the final story. We go back to the cottage. Everyone goes through for dinner. And... what's his name? Craig. Kills the doctor.
Yeah.
After he's told that story, he strangles him to death.
His glasses break, and he is like, "Oh, I realized this bad thing that's going to happen. I have to kill you.
It's because of me." Yeah. And he completely loses it and starts to have like hallucinations about all the stories that have been told. So they all kind of come in and out. You've got the kids from the hide and seek, the bus conductor, the hearse driver, whichever one pops up and says like, "There's room for another inside." And then
he gets thrown in the jail cell.
Oh my God. He gets thrown in the jail cell and Hugo is sitting there. Mm-hmm. And then Hugo kind of, as in,
moves his head, the puppet,
moves his head by himself.
Yeah.
And then we have like a small person, a short person. It's obviously dressed up in the ventriloquist dummy garb and stands up and walks over to Craig. Holy shit, that still holds up as being genuinely terrifying.
It's still scary, yeah.
There's something about the way that he moves and the makeup on his face that is just horrifying.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was this scene that messed me up as a kid.
Yeah. It's scary.
He walks over and he kind of leans into
climbs onto the bed, yeah. Like climbs over him, and
it's...
And then it cuts like to his perspective to this like close up of the dummy's face.
Yeah.
And it's talking to him.
Not fun.
It's genuinely
didn't
scary.
Didn't enjoy that.
And like one of the things that I don't know if I noticed it the first time I watched this. I'd only seen this film once before, about a year ago. The crowd in the ventriloquist show in this bit at the end, this like fever dream, whatever, when he's like running around. They've all got like painted faces.
Yeah.
They're all like made up, and they've got these like twisted grins, and it's quite subtle. It's not like super over the top like clown makeup, but it's just enough that it looks really uncanny. Yeah.
And they've got like eyeliner, so their eyes are they're like more prominent.
Yeah, and like kind of big grins, and it's it's creepy.
It is really creepy. It works. And then we get like a hard cut to Craig waking up in the morning. It's all just been a nightmare. It's fine. It's all good. It's just been a bad dream.
Yeah.
And then he gets a phone call from Elliot Foley.
Yeah.
Who asks him to come and visit his cottage mansion. His countryside house or whatever. Mm-hmm. So he gets in his car and he goes, and then the scene from the end merges into the scene from the very start, which is his car pulling up to the cottage.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh no. He's trapped in a loop.
Mm-hmm.
I think it works really well.
Yeah,
on the whole,
it does.
I think it's an enjoyable film. It has its ups and downs. The golf story is a low
notable
point.
Down. Yeah.
But the rest of the stories are fine, if not good or great, and the kind of influence that it has had on films since then
is very influential,
very notable. Yeah. You know, you can tell when you watch this film, despite it being in black and white and some of the sets not being amazing, you can tell that there were a lot of folk inspired by this film.
Yeah.
So, I enjoyed it, but I gave it a 3.5.
Three and a half is pretty strong.
And I think it was because I couldn't give it more than that, because the golf story is actively bad. Actively didn't like it. The hide and seek story, again, didn't really enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a bit flat. And interesting that you said the mirror story was good. I liked it, but it's like my third favorite.
Yeah.
It's third place after the first two.
I like it. Yeah, I think I like the subtlety of it. I think it's a lot of fun. It feels like kind of like a Twilight Zone episode or something.
I think it would work in sort of like a half hour episode would be good. But yeah, so my point is, it's a mixed bag. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't really give it more than that, because even though I would rank like the first story like 4.5 or 5, those ones are like 1. So I had to even it out. But it's still good. It's still worth a watch, and it's worth, you know, looking at each of these individual stories and seeing what it has inspired since.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I couldn't give it more than 3.5.
Yeah.
Maybe it was a bit harsh, but
no, it's fair enough. I was actually a little bit more critical than you were.
Oh.
I was actually a little more harsh. Because unfortunately, like, I agree pretty much with everything that you're saying. Like, the first, third, and fifth stories mm-hmm. are all good. I think the overarching plot is good.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's got a really solid ending. But I think a lot of the stories have issues. The second and fourth are, like, particularly not enjoyable. And unfortunately, it just makes the film, like, not really worth watching. Like, I think if you could go and watch, like, the good bits completely out of context, like, maybe just, like, watch one or two of the segments.
Yeah.
But even then, like, I don't know if they do that much that by today's standards is really all that good. Very influential, but... yeah. So in the end, I gave it 2.5.
Okay. Which I think is it's still down the middle.
It does feel like a bit of a harsh rating. I would maybe revise that a bit later on and give it a bit higher. Maybe it was just this time watching it, I was a little bit less impressed. But it's such a shame because it is just really, really mixed. Like, it's not, you know, this 2.5 isn't like the whole film all the way through is just mediocre. It's just because it keeps jumping up and down in terms of quality. Like, it, you know, it starts strong and then takes a huge dip. And then goes back to being pretty good and then takes another huge dip. And it's like, you know.
Mixed bag. It is a mixed very much, bag.
Very much.
But, you know, after 80 some years or near about 80 years.
Yeah.
I don't know that it holds up by today's standards,
mm-hmm.
but I can still appreciate it after 8 years. I think there's moments there that are still genuinely very scary.
Yeah.
And that's something to be said for the quality of the writing at the time. So, yeah, make your own opinion.
Yeah.
Go watch it for yourselves. It's on Shudder. Get Shudder.
Is it on Shudder?
Shudder, sponsor us, please. But yeah, it is.
Cool. Yeah.
Okay. Moving on to your pick for this week.
Move on to my pick. Yeah. My pick for this week was Anthony Hickox's Waxwork from 1988, which is a much more ridiculous film. It's very goofy. I didn't realize going into, like, I knew going into it that it was going to have a very, like, a quite a silly, campy tone. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that it was specifically a horror comedy. I thought that it was just like a horror that was from the late 80s. Like, it was just a kind of goofy, low budget horror movie. I didn't realize that they were actually steering into horror comedy. But yeah, they are. So the premise of the film is that our main character, Mark, played by Zach Galligan, who you probably know from Gremlins and
Gregory's Girl? Is he Gregory's Girl?
No.
Which one's Gregory's Girl?
I don't know. Some Scottish guy.
Oh.
Gregory's Girl is very Scottish. I don't think there was a single American in that cast. Got why? Claire Grogan in it.
Why do I always... I don't know why
they
I
look pretty similar. Them. They do. He, like, the guy in Gregory's Girl looks kind of like Zach Galligan.
Maybe
in
that's what it is.
Or
maybe
kind of just... like a very young Tom Hanks.
Maybe it's... Yeah.
He has that kind of 80s soft boy vibe with, like, the curly hair, you know?
Yeah. Maybe it's just they look similar. I don't know.
They just do look similar. Yeah. Anyway, yeah. Gremlins 2.
Playing a very different character.
Very different. Because, like, in Gremlins, he's not poor, but, like, working class. He's sort of in the suburbs. He works in a bank. He's a bit, like, he's got this sort of beaten up old car. And he's just this, like, really kind of sweet, charming young man who's, like, hardworking. And, you know, he's, like, an artist on the side. And then in this, he's, like, a bit of a rich asshole.
Yeah.
He's, like, a yuppie. I quite liked it. Like, I think it was kind of weird seeing him playing such a different character because I love Gremlins and I have seen, it's maybe the film I've seen more than any other.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I was really, this is like the only other thing I've ever seen Zach Galligan in. And it's just, it was really funny seeing him playing a different character. But I still kind of liked him in this. I thought he was fun. He wasn't like a terrible guy, even though he was rich. He was just a sort of, he was a bit weird.
He was pretty terrible. at the start of the film, anyway.
Yeah, he's not great. He's a bit weird about the fact that the girl he fancies is dating somebody else.
Yeah,
to their, like, his ex-girlfriend.
To their face.
He's very, yeah.
Very jealous. And
yeah, a bit of a nice guy, I think, early in the film.
Incel.
Bit of an incel.
Incel vibes.
Anyway, so he's kicking about. He's got some of his assorted other friends. China, as we mentioned, is his love interest. I don't know why they called her China.
No idea.
Played by Michelle Johnson, who was also in Death Becomes Her. Not as one of the main characters. I don't know who it was that she played in Death Becomes Her, but apparently she
ironic,
was Death Becomes Her.
Because
ironic, because Death Becomes Her. Tony, who is played by Dana Ashbrook, who we talked about last week. He was in Twin Peaks. He was Bobby Briggs in Twin Peaks. And then he was in Return of the Living Dead Part 2.
No, Part 2.
Part 2.
The worst
not, of... Not the good one. And he is the brother of Dashney Ashbrook, who played Grace in Doctor Who, the TV movie.
Oh, yeah.
Which is, I think, the reason that I knew about... Well, yeah. Not the reason I knew about him. It's the reason I recognized his name when I watched Twin Peaks for the first time. And then also two other people who weren't especially famous, and I didn't bother to write their names down. Oh, and sorry, and also Sarah, who's played by Deborah Foreman, who is in April Fool's Day, the slasher film from the early 80s.
Nice.
So the six of them are going to this waxwork museum that is, for some reason, in the middle of like a suburban neighborhood. They even comment on like, why is this here?
It's like just a house. It's just a house that's been...
It's just a really big, kind of weird looking house that's been turned into a waxwork museum. China and Sarah are like walking past it in the morning and they're like, oh, that's a weird place to put a waxwork museum anyway. And then they turn back around and suddenly everyone's favorite, most incredible actor of all time, David Warner, is standing there just dripped out to the fucking nines in this completely ridiculous outfit. And he's like, yeah, it's a waxwork museum. You want to come in for a private showing at midnight? And that doesn't make him sound like a complete monster. But they're like, yeah, sure, why not? So they gather all of their friends. Dana Ashbrook's wearing incredibly short trousers. It's very funny. And then they're all like, come on into the Waxwork Museum. They go in. One of the like really kind of iconic things about this film, it was like in the poster, is the character of Hans, who is played by Mihaly Mezeros. I'm probably pronouncing his name wrong. I'm not sure where he's from, so I don't know how I'm supposed to inflect his voice. Inflect his my voice on his name, you know what I mean.
Yeah.
He was one of the actors who played Alf.
Oh, really?
Which is fun.
He was Alf.
He was also on the album cover of The Doors' Strange Days. It's a pretty famous album. There's like a big strong man on the cover.
I don't know if I recognize it.
And he's like standing next to him, and the strong man, he's like doing a little dance.
Okay.
Anyway, that was him. So he's like this kind of straight, he's like a little butler, and he's a little person, I should say.
Yeah.
And he lets them in and is kind of weird, and he's got this like a bit of a squeaky voice and like a German accent and is a bit strange. Welcomes them into the waxwork museum. They go in, they start kicking about looking at all these waxworks of like monsters and like...
All very clearly not wax and just actors standing just very still.
I did think it was really funny. I was expecting them to move because I was like, obviously the thing here is they're going to get locked in the waxwork museum and all of the waxworks are going to come to life. And that's not what happens.
No.
But I assumed that was what the plot was. Especially when I saw the actors very clearly just guys standing still. The first one that we see is Frankenstein's monster, who, fun fact, was played by Kane Hodder.
Oh, really?
Who at this time was playing Jason. He's like uncredited in his... He's like credited as doing stunts in the film, but they don't specifically say that that was him as Frankenstein's monster.
That's very cool.
But there you go.
I didn't
Frankenstein's monster. And then there's like a werewolf. There's like a vampire. There's like Jack the Ripper. There's the Invisible Man. You kind of see a few of them. We see more of them later on. I don't think I did copy down the list of all of the characters, but there's a bunch of different, horror movie cliche characters. So they're all walking around this waxwork museum. Tony, Dana Ashbrook character, goes over to the werewolf exhibit, goes to light up a cigarette, but then like drops his lighter into the exhibit, and he's like, ah, no one's around, no one's gonna mind if I step over the velvet rope and go and pick up my lighter. And then he steps in through this like portal and disappears, It's very 80s special effects when he steps 80s. Over it and it goes like woo woo woo, and then he like goes through it and suddenly he's got long hair and he's wearing like 18th century German farm boy clothes.
Yep.
And he's in the woods in the middle of the night and he becomes convinced that he's been hypnotized or drugged or something.
Yeah.
He doesn't know what's going on. He's like, oh, I need to figure out. And he finds a house and he goes over to the house and...
And he finds Gimli.
I got so excited because I didn't know that John Rhys-Davies was in this.
Yeah, neither did I.
And I was like, oh my god, it's John Rhys-Davies. He's fun. Yeah, Gimli from Lord of the Rings and Sala from Indiana Jones. He has a pretty small role in this, which is weird because this would have been post Indiana Jones. Yeah.
He does talk, doesn't he? He does have a wee bit of dialogue.
He's got a really nice voice.
He does.
John Rhys-Davies has a really good voice. And he's like... kind of like, oh, don't come in, stay away, I told you to get out of here, it's not safe. So of course we know what's going on, that he's going to turn into a werewolf.
Yeah.
Dane Ashbrook goes in, John Rhys-Davies turns into a werewolf, a bunch of village, and like he attacks Tony, he starts to turn into a werewolf as well. Some villagers come in with a gun with some silver bullets and they wind up killing Tony. And then it cuts back to the Waxwork Museum, and now Tony's half-transformed dead body is, like, lying in the corner of the exhibit.
Yeah.
Goofy-looking
werewolf, by the way.
It looks like
an Easter Bunny outfit that's been, like, painted grey.
It wasn't a great outfit. It kind of reminded me of The Howling, which I don't like the werewolf designs in The Howling.
Mm.
I think The Howling has a really good transformation sequence. It uses like the bladder effects,
yeah.
So where people like the skin's like bulging and like they do a sort of gradual transformation, and I think it works well. I just don't like the werewolf designs in The Howling.
Okay.
And in Waxwork it looked very similar to that.
It's like
I love a good werewolf design, but it has like very very big ears, which looks strange.
We don't really
see the transformation. This film didn't have much of a budget. I think it's quite obvious in a few of the scenes with the special effects where it's like they don't show much.
Mm-hmm.
Like not in the sense that they're being subtle, just in the sense that like they don't actually show you any of what's going on because they clearly didn't have a big enough special effects budget to do it effectively, which is good. It's better to not show it than to show it and have it look shit.
True.
But it would be best to show it and have it not look shit.
I would also say that one of the very few things about this film that I did enjoy was the creature design. And on the whole, the werewolf was a bit goofy.
Yeah.
But all the other ones, like later on dummies, like the mummy and the vampires, and there's some creepy, like...
There's like a snake man.
Yeah.
And like a freak show thing.
But they look pretty good. Like, they look pretty creepy. They did well with the budget they had, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Did a decent job. Just the werewolf was not great.
Yeah. one of the villagers that comes in and tries to kill them gets ripped in half. John Rhys-Davies grabs him and pulls him in half sideways, which is like a cool kill. I like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that it was a cool effect. It was pretty well done. So like, it's mixed. I think there are quite a lot of places. It's sort of an anthology, weirdly. Like, it has these like quite long segments.
Yeah.
It doesn't really commit to doing that for the whole film, but like at this point we're getting a few of these little chunks of like a character gets pulled into one of the exhibits and then we see them by themselves having this little story, which I kind of like. I sort of wish it would have been better if they, I think it would have been better if they had committed to it a lot more. But yeah, anyway, the next segment after the werewolf one is China goes into like the vampire exhibit,
mm-hmm,
with Count Dracula. Apparently he is specifically Count Dracula. They don't really call him as such in the film.
Because
they
didn't say Count Dracula.
But apparently he's credited as Count Dracula.
Okay.
And she like gets ushered to sit down at his table and they're eating like raw meat. And then she excuses herself and she goes downstairs. She's like, she gets sucked into the story. She knows that like her husband, quote unquote, within the plot of this little segment is somewhere in the castle and she's like going to try and find him. She goes down into the basement and finds that he's like strapped to the table and his leg's been not amputated, but like they've cut all of the flesh off of the bottom half of his leg.
Left. It's pretty,
I thought it was pretty gross.
Upsetting.
It's cool though.
Yeah.
It's scary. And then the point I was getting to with this bit is when she starts fighting off the vampires at this point in the basement. She like kills a couple of them with like a, she breaks a chair and makes like, has like the stakes and she kills a couple of them like that. She makes a crucifix with, it's like two scalpels, I think.
It's two knives, yeah.
Two knives or whatever. Yeah. And then like presses it against the vampire's forehead and his head explodes. Uh-huh. And it's like, I like that it's super gory. Like when she stakes the vampires, there's all this blood like spraying out all over this white room. And it looks really cool. But they don't show you like the stake going into the chest. Mm-hmm. That's like probably the best example of what I mean by like, they're not actually showing you anything. It's graphic, but they're not going too up close with it because clearly they didn't quite have the budget for that.
Yeah.
So it's not about subtlety. It's just about them not being able to show it.
There's a lot of quick cuts and everything as well while she's killing them, and it's kind of, oh, what's going on?
It makes it feel a bit janky. I think it definitely shows off that this film did not have a great budget. One of two things that makes me really know that the film had a shit budget. But like, I kind of liked this bit. When she's killing the vampires, I liked all of, like the visual style of like the stark white like clinical room with all the blood spraying all over the place and like the shock of this guy with his leg just down to the bone was pretty cool.
It just went on for so long.
It does go on.
This segment is it just keeps going.
Yeah. And then it ends with China getting got anyway.
Yeah.
Dracula kills her and then it sort of cuts back and she's, because when she sees the exhibit, Dracula's like hunched over this body, mm-hmm. and then she turns out to be the body that is being blood sucked,
exsanguinated.
That's
you
the
taught
word.
Me that word.
Yeah, it's a good word. Then they at this point they go away from the story for a little bit. They're like, oh, our friends have gone missing. We need to figure out what's going on. Sarah and Mark are then like trying to figure out what's going on. They go to the police. That doesn't go anywhere because then when the police show up to the waxworks, nothing's going on. David Warner is very kind of charming and just sort of laughs it off and is like, oh yeah, no, it's just waxwork museum, isn't it? And they kind of go like, yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, it's fine.
And then they leave. And it's not until like later on they go, but like the cop goes back because he figures out that he recognizes a couple of people in the exhibits, and it's not until later on he realizes that they're like missing persons cases. Mm. So he realizes that like, oh, actually Mark was telling the truth about like there's something going on with these bodies, and he like takes a sample from China's face and realizes that it's actually like fleshy underneath like the top layer of wax.
Pulls away the wax from her cheekbones.
It's... which is kind of gross. And then he gets gotten in the mummy exhibit. We get a little segment of him where he's like he's like an Indiana Jones type. He's like the assistant to this Egyptologist and they fight the mummy and then he gets gotten. And then we get another couple of segments a bit later on with Mark and Sarah when they go back to the Waxworks Museum to try and figure out further what's going on with their friends. Sarah gets pulled into the Marquis de Sade has a exhibit, I guess. I guess he's on par with Count Dracula and Frankenstein's monster.
Who is the Marquis de Sade?
He was just a guy. He was a guy who was like a sadist.
Oh.
He's the guy that sadism is named after.
Oh, Marquis de Sadism.
Yeah.
Mark the
sadist. And yeah, he was just like a kind of fucked dude who liked sexually torturing people.
Cool.
He like hosted big parties where they like kind of tortured servants and...
I mean, it's pretty bad.
It's pretty bad. It's fucked. And then they have this thing where like Sarah gets involved. She like gets pulled in and then she's getting like whipped, but then she's sort of into it and she doesn't want to leave. But it's kind of unclear if that's just because she's been sort of possessed by the exhibit, or if it's actually because she just is a masochist and wants to stay there. I guess it's a bit weird.
We don't know.
At this point, Mark gets pulled into the zombie exhibit, which is basically Night of the Living Dead. It's like in a graveyard. It goes black and white when he's in there, and the visual style of the film changes quite a lot. They keep doing these like low angles, and it sort of tries to evoke the feeling of like a 60s like Plague of the Zombies, Night of the Living Dead
quite well,
kind of thing.
I think it's not bad.
I think they do. I really like that. And when I was watching it, I was like, I wish they had done that more with the other segments.
Mm.
I really liked that they like did the they changed the style of the film to emulate
the
stories that they were doing.
Yeah.
But he kind of goes in, he sort of fights the zombies off. He figures out, like, oh, but if this isn't real, if I don't believe in it, I can just leave.
Mm-hmm.
So he leaves the exhibit, then goes into the Marquis de Sade exhibit to go and rescue Sarah, kind of fights with the Marquis de Sade and is like, you can't hurt me because I know that you're not real, and then gets Sarah and rescues her, and the two of them leave and go back to the present day. And then we get a really, really messy ending.
I could give you a different question, a different answer to the question, what happens at the end of this film, for the next year, every day for the next year,
mm-hmm.
and I would not have been able to predict this.
It's like, yeah. So a character that we briefly saw a bit earlier on, played by Patrick McNee.
Oh, good old Patrick McNee.
Is it McNee or McGee?
McNee.
Because one of them was the one in The Prisoner. And one of them is the one that was in the Avengers.
Yeah.
McNee's the one that was in the Avengers, no. Right?
This is McNee.
This is McNee.
Yeah.
Patrick McNee, who's like, he was a friend of Mark's grandfather, and he was like an explorer or whatever, and he was like an expert on the occult. He's just this kind of weird character. He's in a wheelchair. He shows up pretty late on in the film and has one scene at this point where he gives him a bit of exposition and that's it. And then shows up right at the end for this final battle in this like armored wheelchair with like an army of guys who are these like upper class, like they're in like a guild of like magic good guys who fight evil, including Mark's butler, who was in one scene at the beginning of the film, and he's just sort of there. And then they have a giant people referred to it as a pub fight.
It is.
Like, I think
it
the writer absolutely. Himself referred to it as a
brawl.
Pub fight. It's like they're just, all of the waxworks come to life and are fighting. And it's just like super quick cuts. It's a solid 5 to 10 minutes of just constant quick cuts. There's no like narrative. It's just the monsters and the guys fighting each other.
It's ridiculous.
It's ridiculous, and it's not good. And there's a very good reason for it, and it's because they ran out of money. They had another ending planned, and then they were like, they got to the end where they were like about to go and shoot this big dramatic conclusion at the end of the film, and then they were like, oh, we don't have any money left. Why don't we just take a day, get everyone we can get on set, dress them up in whatever costumes we've got on hand, and just film them roughing each other up for a bit. And that's what they did. And that's the conclusion of the film. And it's not good. The ending is genuinely such a mess. But it does have an incredible bit where Dracula transforms into a bat, tries to fly away, gets grabbed by somebody who puts a revolver into his face and says, "Do you feel lucky?" and then shoots him. And the bat just explodes.
I could not believe what I had just seen. I was like, I had to rewind it and was like, did I just watch this correctly? Yeah.
I had to pause the film because I was howling with laughter.
Yeah.
I was like, I almost fell off the couch. I was like, doubled over, crying, laughing.
It was
so funny.
Ridiculous.
I don't know if they were really going for that kind of laugh with that. But like I say, this is a horror comedy and it does have some pretty funny bits in it. I thought at least
so absurd.
It's just silly.
The fact his head gets blown like clean off.
Yeah. 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 And then they have this conclusion with Patrick McNee and David Warner, who are like, they suggest that the two of them are like rivals, yeah, but like there's no setup for that. They both have these big like sci-fi looking guns for some reason. They don't have regular guns. They've got like big, they look like props from Doctor Who or something. And they both like shoot at each other. David Warner gets shot and falls into a vat of wax. Does the jump scare of like, oh, I'm actually still alive. Oh, no, I'm not.
Yeah.
And dies. And then Patrick McNee gets eaten by a werewolf.
Yep.
And then the Waxwork Museum burns down, and that's the end of the film.
Yep.
And over the end credits, they play Leslie Gore's It's My Party and I'll Cry If I Want To.
Yep.
For some reason.
Was
yeah.
that not Rihanna or Taylor Swift or somebody that did that?
Did they do a cover of that?
I don't know.
I don't know, maybe.
That's the only time I've ever heard it.
Yeah.
Like, it's my party and I'll do what I want. And
is that
Black Eyed Peas? I don't know. It's someone. I don't know. I didn't realize it was a real song.
Yeah, it was like an old song from like the 60s.
Yeah.
Apparently, specifically trying to emulate American Werewolf in London, how it has Blue Moon playing over the end credits. Hmm. Like that, like sort of very cheery, older song playing in the end credits. They were specifically trying to do that.
It doesn't work.
It doesn't work.
No. The music for the rest of the film is all right, though. It's very gremlin-y.
It is very gremlin-y.
Yeah.
It has quite a fun score. Like the opening credit, the opening credits and like the end credits. And there's a bit when Mark and Sarah, they like leave university. They like go to university together.
Yeah.
They like leave to go and investigate the Waxwork Museum. There's like a bit of music that plays over that. That's really good. There's a bit at the beginning that I thought it was Hold Me Now by the Thompson Twins, but it wasn't. It was just an original bit of music that sounded a lot like it. When Mark leaves the house,
mm-hmm.
it's this really like upbeat 80s jam. It's just weird. But
that sums up the whole
enjoyable.
Film.
Enjoyable. I knew watching this that you were not going to like this film. But I really enjoyed it.
Oh my God.
I don't necessarily think it was good. It had significant flaws. But for about 90% of its runtime, I was just having a great time watching it.
I'm judging you.
I was having a really fun time.
No, I would never judge you for enjoying something.
I have another fun fact that I want to give before we get into your opinion.
Okay.
Hoping that this is going to sway your, it's probably not actually. If anything, it's going to make you think it's worse. Because you're going to be disappointed that it wasn't in it. In the original script, they had more plans for the Waxworks. Mm-hmm. They wrote various other characters. Because obviously you got like Dracula, the Invisible Man, Werewolf, yeah. Mummy, whatever. In the original script, they were planning on having, actually, three characters from other horror films. Do you want to guess? And I'll see if you can guess who it would have been that they were going to include.
I mean, what was this? 88?
88.
My guess would be Michael Myers, Freddy Krueger, and Jason Voorhees.
You got one out of three right.
Okay.
They were planning on putting Jason Voorhees in it.
All right.
And then they couldn't get the license for it. There's a scene when it's one of their other friends goes. He's the one who gets gotten by the Phantom of the Opera. He like goes in and he's looking at the Phantom of the Opera, and David Warner's like, oh, would you like to get a closer look? And then like pushes him in. And then it just cuts to him like dead on the floor in the exhibit.
Jack Torrance?
No.
Oh.
No, not Jack Torrance. The other two are weird. Anyway, sorry, just still while we're on Jason before I tell you the other two, that bit when he says like, oh, the Phantom of the Opera, I know him. There's films about the Phantom of the Opera.
Yeah.
And David Warner is like sort of looks at him and says like, they made films about the Phantom of the Opera, and it's kind of suggesting that in that universe he was a real person and they didn't know that there were films about him as well, I guess. That line was originally written about Jason Voorhees.
Okay.
There were going to be like, cool. He was going to say like, they made a movie about the Camp Crystal Lake killings or whatever. And it was going to be like a Jason Voorhees in the exhibit.
It's kind of cool.
I guess it's quite funny.
Yeah.
And because he says something about like, oh, I'm going to go and steal the mask for my own private collection or whatever. So I guess the suggestion was it was going to be like, he's going to take the hockey mask or something. Anyway, no, the other two characters they were going to include were the kids from the Village of the Damned.
Okay.
Which I could probably see working. Yeah. and The Thing from John Carpenter's The Thing.
What?
I do not know
which version.
I do not know how they even could have dreamed that they would get the license for them.
No, that's ridiculous.
But yeah, apparently that was their original plan. They were going to feature those three amongst all the classic monsters.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, that's my fun fact. Okay, do you want to tell me your opinion on Waxwork?
I don't know if I do, to be honest. I want to forget I ever watched this film.
Yeah.
So, there were no likable characters. I did not give a shit about any of them.
You don't give a shit about Dana Ashbrook and his really short trousers.
I couldn't even remember his name. I did not care. Yeah. I didn't care. The only person that I had a little bit of care for was John Rhys-Davies, mm-hmm. and he died.
He's barely in it.
Yeah, he turned into a werewolf very quickly. Even David Warner, who I love, does not save this.
Yeah.
I just didn't care about any of the characters. The scenes go on for so long. There's... like, I can just picture it now. There's scenes where Mark is getting, like, attacked. There's the scene where he gets chased by, like, the butler, the tall, like, Munster-esque butler guy. And they're like, oh, I'm going to get you. Oh, I'm going to get you. And he's, like, just out of reach. Yeah. And he keeps, like, and they're, like, jogging lightly through the house. And I was like, ugh.
Yeah.
It was so frustrating to watch because all the like segments were like that. It just felt so scripted and mm-hmm. so unnatural. The segments went on way too long, especially the vampire one, which just dragged and dragged and dragged. The Marquis de Sade one as well. I don't know if they wanted to like give more time on the females. Like the woman stories, you know what I'm saying. I didn't mean to say like females as a noun. I meant to be like the female storylines. Mm-hmm. I know you don't like it when I say that. You know what I was trying to say. Those two stories, they just dragged for so long. And the ending was just ridiculous.
The ending's really not good.
Like shooting the bat in the head.
Shooting the bat.
That made
me
giggle. I did enjoy that. I can appreciate that. The mm-hmm. rest of it, I was just like, what happened? What is going on? There was no indication that those wax figures could come to life. They were in another like dimension.
Yeah.
There was no explanation as to why there's another dimension.
No.
David Warner just gets shot and dies, and you're like, oh, well, I guess we'll never know.
They do have this very, very brief and very, very vague, like, black magic, evil, he's a witch. He worships Satan, I guess, sort of thing. And they don't give it any explanation. They do have this very vague thing of like, it's kind of time travel-y. Like, it's actually like a gateway to like a pocket of the past where something horrible happened, and like by going there and fulfilling that horrible thing happening, you're giving him more power. I guess it's stupid. It's very dumb. It like they clearly came up with the concept and then just filled in that bullshit explanation.
It sounds like they were like, let's make a horror slasher set in a waxworks.
Yeah.
How do we do that?
Mm-hmm.
And then they just kind of winged it.
Yeah.
I gave it 1 out of 5. And that is only because some of the practical effects were pretty cool. Mm-hmm. Like the actual designs of the waxworks were pretty cool. And shooting bat in the head.
Yeah.
Made me laugh. So okay. I couldn't give it half a star. But I hated it.
Wow. Okay.
I'm sorry.
No, fair enough. That's fine. I basically went in the exact opposite direction, and I was like, there's like one or two things about this film I didn't like, and everything else I thought was really pretty great. Not necessarily great quality-wise, but just such a fun watch. There's like really not much about it I didn't enjoy. Basically, I think the ending is a complete mess. and I wish they had had more money that they could commit to the special effects more. It definitely has like pacing issues, which I guess is kind of an extension of the ending being shit. Like, they don't do a good enough job setting up the overarching plot, and then like the pacing of the bits in between the little monstery bits don't really work very well. But yeah, pretty much I gave it a 4 out of 5, which is a high score for me. And I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed it enough that yesterday, so I watched this film on Saturday. I know you don't like me giving away schedule. I watched this film on Saturday and really enjoyed it. And then yesterday I was just looking for another film to watch, and I decided I was going to watch Waxwork 2 Lost in Time, the sequel. It's not as good. You would probably absolutely hate it. But the thing about Waxwork 2 is that it commits so much more to the like kind of pseudo anthology aspect. To give you a very brief synopsis of the plot, Mark and Sarah, having escaped from this, are wanted by the police, or Sarah specifically is wanted by the police because there's like the hand from the zombie exhibit that like lives, it survives the end of the film. It like follows her home and kills her stepdad, kills her abusive stepdad, and then she's wanted by the police. They, or like she gets arrested for the crime, and they are trying to say like, oh, but the waxworks came to life, it's magic, and no one believes them, obviously. So they go to Patrick McNee's house and they find a time machine. And they start jumping around through different points in time.
God.
To try and find proof that the dead can come back to life in order to get Sarah off of the conviction. But like all of the bits they go to are like parodies of horror films, and they commit to that thing that we were saying about the zombie segment where they like change the visual style to match the bit that they're parodying. And it works really well, but like, again, has very serious pacing issues. There's like a couple of 10-minute segments, and then there's one big like 45-minute long segment that's like the original content of the film that's shit, like absolute dog shit. And then they have one really fun montage at the end where they're jumping around basically different horror films. Having like a big sword fight. They go to like Dawn of the Dead and they're having a sword fight in Dawn of the Dead and like Godzilla, and they're like, it cuts to like black and white and they're all like badly dubbed over because it's like a Japanese film. It's really silly.
I could dig that. That
and it's
sounds
not
funny,
like good.
Yeah.
But it's really fun that like Anthony Hickox clearly had this fun idea for the first film, didn't have the budget for it, and then for the second film was like, you know what, fuck it. We're not going to put any effort into anything else. We're just going to do this.
Yeah.
And it has a great, it basically does a parody of The Haunting for like a 15-minute segment that's just a parody of The Haunting with Bruce Campbell as like the Dr. Markway kind of character.
Right.
And I think it's maybe the single best bit of like horror parody work I've ever seen in my life. It's honestly fantastic.
I'll and maybe watch the individual segments.
Watch
from
like
it
just that bit.
I do not want to watch the films.
I will try and find that individual bit to show you because it's genuinely really, really funny.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, I liked Waxwork. I thought it was a lot of fun. For someone who like me who loves Gremlins, which is just this really silly film, I feel like this kind of has a tonal similarity.
How dare you?
To something like Gremlins.
Gremlins is so good.
Gremlins is a lot better quality-wise. Yeah. Like, it's actually a good film, whereas this is just silly and cheesy. But like, I feel like it has that horror comedy tone.
It doesn't balance it as well as Gremlins does. Gremlins balances the horror and the comedy quite nicely. This, I don't feel did.
No.
I feel like it was just...
No, I would agree. It's like, for quite a good chunk of it, it feels like it's just a horror film that isn't very good. And it feels like you're laughing at it rather than with it.
Yeah.
Every so often, I felt like they did something that felt genuinely quite funny. But for a lot of the film, it was more like I was laughing at it than with it. But still, I was laughing, so I think it was good.
Listen, I won't judge. You know, you do you.
Yeah.
You did panic me, though, because when we revealed our theme for next week, you said, can I just pick Waxwork 2, which I've just watched? And I said, no.
I didn't.
Please, for the love of God, do not make me watch a sequel to this film.
I assumed that you wouldn't have liked Waxwork, okay. So I wasn't going to, because I didn't want to subject you to two Waxwork films over the course of 2 weeks.
Yes. We would have needed to go on hiatus after that. Yeah. Like, calm down.
I've actually picked a much better film for next week.
For the theme of time travel. Time travel is an interesting one for horror.
Yeah.
Because it's very much a sci-fi genre.
There's not a lot of horror films that feature time travel.
Yeah.
Or at least a lot of them, you're either bending the definition of time travel, mm-hmm. or you're bending the definition of horror.
Yeah.
I would say.
Yep.
So it is a bit of a strange theme.
I'm curious to see what you've picked for it.
Do you want me to go first?
Yeah, go for it.
So, like I say, you either need to go for a film that's not really a horror film or a film that's not really a time travel film. Uh-huh. In the end, I'm going for a film that's arguably not really a horror film. It's kind of more of a dark kind of neo-gothic drama with some supernatural elements. Mm. I'm going with Donnie Darko.
Oh, okay. That's an interesting choice from you.
I feel like it's been quite a while since I've watched it. This is a film that I have watched quite a few times and I think is really quite good, or at least I did maybe 10 years ago when I was a teenager and I watched it. And recently I have been in the mood to watch it again, partly because I've been listening to the soundtrack. I think it's got a really good soundtrack.
Good soundtrack.
And it's making me want to watch it again.
Fair enough.
And I think since watching films like that, the term neo-gothic, as much as I am just using it now, probably isn't the best way to describe it, but I'm thinking of films like Ginger Snaps or something like The Craft, which we also compared Ginger Snaps to. I think it fits into that, like, it's that Y2K kind of young adult, dark,
edgy vibes,
horror adjacent, sort of spooky and weird.
I'm with you. Yeah.
Kind of feeling.
I'm with you.
I've just been fancying watching it again. I figured this is the first film that came to mind for like horror time travel, as much as it's not really a horror film.
Okay. Okay. I it's got some spooky bits. I would argue it could be defined as a horror.
Yeah.
I'm not against watching it again. It's been so many years since I've seen it, mm-hmm. but I have watched that film countless times when I was that edgy emo teenager.
Yeah.
Cool. I've gone with a new film, one that I had my eye on for a wee while since I saw the trailer. I'm curious to see how it holds up. It's got pretty good reviews. Mm-hmm. Totally Killer.
Oh, okay.
With Kiernan Shipka, mm-hmm. From Mad Men and Sabrina. She's in Sabrina as well.
Yeah.
She gets transported back in time and tries to solve serial killer slasher
murder
spree thing.
Yeah.
I don't really know. I've tried to avoid looking into it as much as possible, but the trailer looked pretty cool. It's got like a new, they marketed it slightly as sort of like the new iconic horror movie mask. Mm-hmm. It's like this sort of, I don't know, it's sort of like a Max Headroom style.
It's just like a
Duke Nukem sort of
rectangular
head with a blonde buzz cut.
It reminded me of like the mask from The Purge.
Yeah.
That's what it looked like to me. Which makes me think it can't be all that iconic if I looked at it and I was just like, that's just the mask from The Purge. But then again, I didn't have that close of a look at it.
So. That's how they're marketing it. I don't think that's gonna work. I don't think that's gonna swing. But apparently it's got good reviews, so I'm keen to watch. It's like a horror comedy as well.
Interested to watch
it. So it's probably an easy watch.
I think I watched the trailer, or maybe a bit of the trailer, and it kind of made me think of like Halloween meets Back to the Future.
Yeah.
Which
it reminded me a little bit more of Happy Death Day.
Yeah.
Which I mentioned before. Which I really quite liked. I thought that was a great film.
I haven't seen it.
It sort of has that kind of vibe in the horror comedy. But yeah, looking forward to it. So
cool. Sounds good.
Give that a watch. A couple of more recent ones then for this week.
Yeah.
Compared to our 1945.
Yeah.
But yes, that was... right. What was the order for it again?
Oh, who cares? Waxworks, Dummies and Mannequins.
So now you don't care.
No.
You were so invested at the start. Yeah, a couple of good ones. Definitely would recommend Dead of Night.
Yeah.
Ewan would probably, if you're looking
this
for
this is
some
the thing, like, I don't know if 80s. I would. Like, I enjoyed it. If you feel like you are the kind of person who has a similar taste in horror movies to me, in that you like dumb, shitty horror movies,
yeah,
I think you should watch Waxwork. I think it's good fun.
Okay.
Give Waxwork 2 a miss. Unless you really fancy Bruce Campbell.
I'm going to leave this to just your own discretion. Because
it's like peak Bruce Campbell, though. 1992 Bruce Campbell.
Bruce Campbell cannot save a film. I'm sorry. He's a great part of many films.
He is.
He cannot save a film.
Yeah.
Okay. Join us next week for some time travel. We'll time travel right now to next Friday.
Yeah.
And record the next episode. Bye, everyone.